This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Last night, Republican presidential candidates squared off for their last debate before the Iowa caucus. A notable absence from the Fox News broadcast debate, GOP frontrunner Donald Trump. Most polls give Trump a healthy lead over his nearest competition, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, while Rubio trails in third place. But what about Jeb Bush? The former governor has redeployed staff to early primary states and unleashed salvos of campaign ads. But to what end? Meanwhile, a Fort Lauderdale-based airline, Silver Airways, is offering free flights to anyone who registers online if either Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush win in Iowa. It's a fair bet to say they won't lose any money on this offer, or will they? How much attention are you paying to Iowa, New Hampshire, or the early caucuses? Are you excited for the Florida caucus? Or are you ready for the election to be over already? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's at 1-866-338-5252. You can join the conversation. And joining me in the studio, Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Welcome back, Frank.
Good morning.
Also joined by Retta Peoples, columnist with the Florida Sun. Welcome back, Retta.
Thank you.
And with us by phone, Daryl Owens, former Orlando Sentinel columnist and editorial writer. He's now communications director at Beacon College. Nice to have you with us, Daryl.
Good morning, Matthew.
Well, the dust is settling after the latest debate before the GOP candidates took the stage on Thursday. That's last night. Candidate Rand Paul said, without Trump, it would be a good debate, focusing on the issues. Well, if you watched it, how did it measure up? Was there more focus on policy without Donald Trump? Our phone lines are open, 1-866-338-5252. What did you hear last night that impressed you or maybe turned you off? Just give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Texas Senator Ted Cruz tried to get Donald Trump out of the way early. Let's hear him at the start of the debate.
Let me say, I'm a maniac, and everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way.
That's Ted Cruz at the start of last night's debate. But Trump still loomed large over the panel. Jeb Bush said he missed the Donald and he was glad he's in the race. Well, national security was also a strong feature in this debate. Here's Jeb Bush talking about his plan to deal with ISIS.
The caliphate of ISIS has to be destroyed, which means we need to arm directly the Kurds, embed our troops with the Iraqi military, re-engage with the Sunni tribal leaders, get the lawyers off the damn backs of the military for once and for all, have a no-fly zone in Syria, and create safe zones to deal with the refugees, but more importantly, to train a Sunni-led force in Syria.
Well, Florida Senator Marco Rubio was also hawkish on defense. Let's hear Rubio talking about ISIS.
This group needs to be confronted and defeated. They are not going to go away on their own. They're not going to turn into stockbrokers overnight or open up a chain of car washes. They need to be defeated militarily, and that will take overwhelming U.S. force.
Well, national security was just one aspect of last night's debate. They also talked about the economy. They talked about immigration, many other things. Let's hear from our panelists, though, for their reactions. Frank, I want to start with you. This close to the Iowa caucus, was there anything last night that could have turned the tide for any of these candidates?
You know, you're correct in saying that Donald Trump had a presence over the debate, as he did. You'll recall he had a rival event, which drew a lot of people and raised money for veterans. So even though he wasn't there, he still had an impact on it. I still think he's in good shape going into Iowa next week. You'll notice that all the attention, all the bullseyes were pointed at Ted Cruz, and he was the object of attack last night. He suffered attacks by almost every other member that was on stage last night at some time during the debate. But despite all the attacks, I thought he did rather well. But last night, I really thought it was about the Florida boys. I thought it was about former Governor Jeb Bush and Senator Marco Rubio, both flexing their knowledge on foreign policy as well as the other issues. They had a strong night.
And Jeb, you will recall, also gave a shout-out to Orlando, talking about Puerto Rico, saying that basically with $79 flights to Orlando, basically I was thinking I should fact-check that. I tried to look it up. I couldn't see those $79 flights, but either way, they're cheap. You're saying basically people with the Puerto Rican economy the way it is, they're moving to Orlando in droves.
That's right, and you're right. I don't think it's $79, but the numbers are there. There's a mass exodus due to the Puerto Rican debt crisis on the island, and you're seeing a large influx in moving into Orlando, which is why the Hispanic vote is going to be so important here in the I-4 corridor next year.
Mm-hmm. Daryl Owens, what was your takeaway from last night's debate, just focusing maybe on Jeb Bush's appearance and performance?
Two words, Matthew. Red Bull, as in Jeb must have gulped a couple of energy drinks before last night's performance. Without Donald Trump's constant hectoring, Bush appeared to me to be more vigorous, more relaxed, more at ease with sparring, particularly with Rubio, whose nose he bloodied with a stiff jab on Rubio's immigration flip-flop. At last, it appeared to me that Jeb Bush projected in prime time a presidential mean.
Darryl, is this kind of what you've been expecting, having worked for the Sentinel for so long and sort of seen Jeb Bush in his element as governor? Were you expecting to see more of that at the start of his campaign?
Well, I think everybody was, and that's been one of the great disappointments with Jeb Bush's campaign thus far. He really has appeared to let Donald Trump bully him into submissiveness on the stage, or at least being afraid to fight back. And again, without Donald Trump's overpowering presence on stage last night, Bush was able, again, to be more relaxed and to let his grasp of policy issues come to fore.
1-866-338-5252 is the number. If you watched last night's debate, we'd like to hear from you. What did you hear last night? What did you see from those candidates? Were you disappointed that Donald Trump wasn't there? Maybe you were watching the rival event. As Frank Torres was saying, he was hosting an event or running an event to raise money for veterans pretty much on the same time as that televised debate last night. Reddit people's Rand Paul, as we heard, was looking forward to a more substantive debate in the absence of Donald Trump, probably more stage time too for him. Did you hear or see that last night?
Yeah, actually, I think Rand Paul did a really good job. You know, when he started talking about criminal justice reform, he earned points. You know, he did really well. I think that he, definitely got more airtime since Donald Trump was gone. And, you know, they focused more on the issues as opposed to the insults. So he did a really, really good job.
Darryl Owens, let me come back to you. Marco Rubio has criticized the frontrunners, Cruz and Trump, for, quote, theatrics. And you know, that's after those two have come out swinging. Cruz challenging Trump to a one-on-one debate. Darryl Owens, are you seeing the appetite for political theater dwindling at all? And just not having Trump in the picture last night, did we see less of that theatrics?
Well, you know, I guess I find it difficult to say that the appetite for political kabuki has been whetted given the volume of video cameras covering Trump's competing event last night. What difference did Donald Trump's absence make last night for the candidates? A Trumpless debate allowed them to beat up on Cruz and each other without having to react to Trump's trumpeting. But I'm still awaiting the ratings to see whether Trump or the actual debate was better watched, which would give us an indication on whether the appetite for political theater is dwindling, as you put it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Reddit People's 538 published a story with analysis on the Trump-Fox split. That ruction there, the headline, Donald Trump's Fox News feud may be another sign the GOP is failing. Well, it's a headline, so you can take that with a grain of salt. But do you see, Reddit Peoples, do you see some real ructions in the Republican Party?
Absolutely. I see some discourse there. You know, they're definitely trying to pull together a mess. You know, they have a mess internally, and they're trying to pull that together. And, you know, with Trump, you know, going his way and the other candidates trying to, you know, pull together and go their own way. It's very difficult. And I think they do have some serious problems going on right now.
Now, you wrote a column not too long ago where you talked about the fact that Donald Trump is in some way more of a Tea Party candidate than a Republican candidate.
Mm-hmm.
There are other candidates who kind of tap into that Tea Party vein too. Ted Cruz is one of them. But do you see that Tea Party faction of the GOP sort of splitting away now?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think he should have run as a Tea Party candidate.
You're talking about Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, yes, absolutely. I think he should have run as a Tea Party candidate. He certainly has all of their values, and they're not the typical conservative values that we see within the Republican Party. So I think Republicans should be angry about that because they don't have a candidate that's in the front. That's a front runner because Donald Trump has taken that position from them.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, what do you make of that Trump slight to Fox News? Is that a sign of real trouble for the GOP, or is it just kind of a part of the natural evolution of the party?
You know, the real trouble for the GOP began when Donald Trump started taking the lead in the polls, and there is a part of the GOP, the Republican establishment, the leadership, I believe, that will do whatever it takes to ensure that Donald Trump is the nominee, even if it comes down to a brokered convention. And I think, especially if he wins Iowa next week and rolls on to New Hampshire, you're going to see a lot of panic in the background. It won't be apparent because, you know, you got to keep a show of strength.
Mm-hmm.
But right now you have a lot of people panicking that Donald Trump is doing so well that he can't deliver in victory against a Hillary Clinton in November. So expect more things to happen in the background as we move forward here in the coming weeks.
What about, you know, you mentioned Hillary Clinton there. Are we seeing something similar in the Democratic Party with the Sanders-Clinton battle? Is that, you know, we've seen similar kind of fractures in the Democratic Party too?
Right. And, you know, I think Republican voters and Democratic voters are tired of hearing the same thing. You know, so many candidates, especially on the Republican side, saying the same things. You almost feel like you're a casting director in a movie and people are just running lines. So when you hear something different from a Donald Trump or you hear something different from a Bernie Sanders, it's refreshing. It's something new. And you're interested and you want to see what it's really all about. And I think that's a large base of the appeal for both the outsiders, Donald Trump and even Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side.
Well, let's drill down to the Iowa caucuses a little bit. The first one, Iowa caucuses obviously on Monday. First of the primary states, NPR reported a couple of weeks back on the ad battle between Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio in Iowa. Bush taking a shot at Rubio's attendance record on national security votes. Rubio hitting back, calling his one-time mentor, quote, desperate. You know, what's in it for these two? They're not going to win Iowa, so how important is it for them to spend money in the state?
They're playing for New Hampshire. I think both of them would love a number three finish in Iowa so they can roll into New Hampshire, a place that's a little bit more more on their line, more of that establishment feel, and they'll play better over there. I think Iowa right now is a two-person race between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, and the rest are just sort of moving into New Hampshire, trying to build momentum, because I believe New Hampshire will be the knockout phase. I think you'll see a couple of candidates drop as soon as the results come back from that, and the field could be narrowed down to as little as five, maybe even four.
Reddit Peoples, let me turn that question to you then. And here's a quote from a Politico article quoting an unnamed Republican. Quote, Marco's goal all along has been to survive, wait for other people to get kicked off the island and pick his moment, and that's what you're seeing in Iowa. End quote. Do you expect either Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush to make it as far as Florida?
Actually, unfortunately, I don't see that. He's got a lot of people to wait to get kicked off the island, if that's what he's waiting for. I think Marco Rubio is probably waiting to be selected as a vice president. And Jeb Bush, I just think it's too little too late. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't give enough. And, you know, at this point, I'm not sure if he's going to make it.
Darrell Owens, Marco Rubio has been the target of attack ads leading into the first caucus of Iowa, and he's trying to turn it around, say that's because he's a real threat. What do you make of this argument? Is there some merit in it?
Certainly. I think Rubio realizes that it's still early in the race and that he's waiting for Trump to release his Svengali hold on the huddled, angry masses. After all, as we all know, any frontrunner is just a Howard Dean Howe or some Gary Hart monkey business away from catastrophe. So strategically, I think Rubio's relying on his perceived appeal as a general election candidate and the perception that he has simpatico with Hispanics, although his about-face on immigration may mean that Rubio will have some splaining to do with that particular constituency.
Mm. And as we saw last night in the debate, that the tape doesn't lie, and sometimes those montages can be quite deadly, especially
Absolutely.
With the immigration. Well, whether it's a Howard Dean Howell or anything else, we'll be watching this closely, paying attention to these debates and the caucuses moving forward. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. When we come back, we're going to switch gears a little bit, talk about medical marijuana, that amendment heading for the ballot box in 2016. But will there be enough voters to agree to vote on it in Florida in November? Are you nervous about what the broader access to medical marijuana could mean for Florida? Or is this a step overdue? Is this a step overdue for the Sunshine State? Intersection will be back in a minute.
Stick around. Intersection continues in just a moment here on 90.7 News.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, presenting a new 12-story women's hospital filled with experts in preventative health, personalized maternity services, and the highest level of specialty care, all in one place. Florida Hospital for Women. Because women are one of the reasons life is amazing.
And the forecast for today, sunny with a high near 68 and lows in the mid-40s tonight with clear skies. Look out for more sun tomorrow and a bit warmer with highs reaching the low 70s with a light breeze passing through. Partly cloudy at night with lows in the mid-50s.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Orlando Ballet, presenting The Firebird and Two Familiar Spaces in Dream, a unique mixed bill featuring Firebird's world premiere and original choreography by artistic director Robert Hill. February 5th through the 7th at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets at drphillipscenter.org.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. With me in the studio, Frank Torres with the Orlando Political Observer, also Reta Peoples with the Florida Sun, and joining us by phone, Daryl Owens with Beacon College. And you can join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. We're going to talk about medical marijuana. It's going to go before voters again in November. Supporters say they've gathered enough signatures to get that constitutional amendment on the ballot, and that amendment would allow doctors to prescribe medical marijuana for a range of debilitating conditions, including cancer, among other things. But a similar amendment polling well among voters before the 2014 election failed to get enough votes. So how celebratory should supporters of medical marijuana be right now, given the slow pace of implementation of existing medical marijuana laws? With regards to Charlotte's Web, what would this amendment, if passed, actually mean? What implications do you see for medical marijuana in Florida? Are you waiting for a drug that could bring you real relief? How far off is it? On the other hand, are you worried about what could happen if medical marijuana is more broadly legalized in Florida? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Now, at a press conference yesterday, Morgan said he fine-tuned his strategy. Last go-round, he was focused on younger voters. This time, he says he's going to educate seniors, and this new initiative closes some of the loopholes from his previous ballot language, which faced criticism from the opposition. It includes new language for parental consent for minors and prescriptions only for specific illnesses like ALS, epilepsy, and cancer. Here's Morgan speaking to reporters from his office in Orlando.
And so the people we're talking about are people, in large part, who are fighting for their very lives, or people like my brother, for their quality of life. This is not, let's go have fun.
All right, Reta Peoples, John Morgan, who chairs the United for Care organization that's pushing this amendment, seems pretty chuffed about getting enough enough signatures on that ballot. But is this celebration premature?
Actually, I don't think it's premature, because now that we're in a presidential year, I think that the amendment will pass. You know, the only thing that I feel that people aren't understanding is, or they may feel that medical marijuana is legal already. Mm-hmm. Charlotte's Web is the only one that's legal right now, and it's able to be prescribed by doctors for kids that are suffering from seizures and things like that. However, the entire plant is what this amendment is trying to get legalized for patients, mm-hmm. not recreational. So I think that's something that a lot of people need to understand. But I don't think it's too early. I think that we can definitely celebrate, because this is going to be on a presidential ballot.
Right. So you're saying it's basically just about getting enough voters to the ballot box. And because it's a presidential year, then there's going to be more voters actually showing up, as opposed to 2014 when they really didn't.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What about, I mean, you talk about Charlotte's Web. There's a huge kind of tangle of red tape to get through there. They haven't even started growing the stuff yet, so it's not going to be an easy road.
Right. It's not going to be. It's going to be very hard before they get everything pulled together. There's only 5 growers in the state of Florida that's able to grow it. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be tough to get a lot of that through. But there's also Charlotte's Web. There's Rick Simpson oil. There's, you know, different types of oils that are high in CBD and low in THC, mm-hmm. that people can take. So it's not that typical marijuana that a lot of people have a stigma against.
Right. 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts on this latest development in the medical marijuana battle raging in Florida at the moment? Will you be lining up to vote for this amendment come November? 1-866-338-5252. Frank Torres, what are you seeing from Florida lawmakers when you look at how existing laws are being rolled out? You know, is there a real change in approach from lawmakers? Or is this, if you look at Charlotte's Web, is it basically being tangled up in red tape and kind of strangled to death?
It's being tangled up in red tape and getting strangled to death. You know, I think I was at the press conference yesterday covering Morgan's rollout or announcement. Mm-hmm. And his strategy is really catered to sort of circumvent the legislature. He's completely lost. He's completely lost hope. That they'll accomplish anything, which is why he's giving this a second try. And I also covered him when he did this the first time around.
Right.
He seems to have learned from his mistakes. He depended on younger voters to get them to the polls last time. This time he's going to go after older voters. He removed the loopholes which opponents of the measure used to attack last time, meaning potential access of marijuana to minors, mm-hmm. holding caretakers accountable. So he's taking a lot more calculated, careful approach to getting this thing passed. And I think in front of a general or a presidential election electorate, stands a really good chance of getting it done. So it was a different John Morgan than what you saw from the last time we rolled this out, where he was a little bit more cocky, a little bit more daring. Mm-hmm. He seems to have a strategy this time that, at least to the average follower of the issue, stands a very good chance of passage.
Mm-hmm. What about Florida lawmakers? Do you see many of them getting on side with broader medical marijuana reform? You know, maybe making it a stump speech issue as they're looking to re-election, or maybe brand new politicians running for something?
You know, I think Pam Bondi set the lead on this when she decided she wasn't going to challenge it. I think if the attorney general is going to pass on it, it might get the occasional mention on the stump from some candidate that it's in the state legislature. They'll go on the record opposing it. But I don't think you're going to see any sort of vigorous efforts to try to derail this time around. I think it really is going to be up to the voters. You could see the same organization, the No On Two People, stand up another campaign against it. But all the leverage really is towards getting this thing passed in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Going to go to the phones now. We've got Attilio calling from Longwood. Attilio, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Interesting topic.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
My position on medical marijuana is very simple. If medical marijuana had any medicinal properties, it needs to be approved by the FDA. Is not an issue to be put on a ballot. Mm-hmm. It's a scientific issue. I don't understand why Mr. Morgan is trying to make this a public issue. It, to me, is very clear. If marijuana was a medicine, it needs to be approved by the FDA.
I guess the counter-argument to that, Attilio, and this is what you'll hear from folks who support medical marijuana, is they say, well, you know, it could take too long, or, you know, there are benefits. And basically, they want to try something. There's also the argument from folks who they're kind of, you know, this is a last resort thing for some people. I'm wondering too, do you know anybody who's seeking medical marijuana, who has a dog in this fight from the other side of the argument?
No, I don't.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried about what will happen if the amendment is passed in November?
Definitely, definitely. I don't travel to Colorado anymore. Just because I don't want to be driven around through the mountains by some potheads, okay? If marijuana had medicinal properties, it needs to be approved by the FDA. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a very simple issue.
Attilio, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate you calling in this morning. Daryl Owens, let me just pick up on what Attilio was talking there for a moment and give us the flip side of this. I mean, there are parents out there who are looking for medical marijuana to help. You know, they might have kids who are suffering, but there are also maybe parents who might be worried about what the implications are if broader legislation is passed. So what are some of those concerns?
Well, I'm not sure those concerns are really founded, particularly according to a University of Michigan study that came out late last year that found, after 5 years on the rise, reefer madness for students in the 8th, 10th, and 12th grades nationwide had dipped from 26% in 2013 to 24% in 2014, even though Colorado and Washington both legalized the drug for recreational use. And what's more, that study also found that the 8th and 10th graders reported that it was harder than ever to score some weed than it once was.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've seen some cities and towns try to get ahead of the curve with medical marijuana, setting up parameters for dispensaries, that sort of thing. But when you look at the frustrations growers are experiencing with Charlotte's Web, and also patients waiting for the stuff, for that matter, how much red tape is getting ready to unspool from this potential broadening of medical marijuana in the Sunshine State if, you know, voters go for it in November?
Well, potentially plenty. As you pointed out, growers and potential end users' hopes are rooted in the expectation of the passage of United for Care's more wide-ranging medical marijuana ballot initiative that would enshrine in the Florida Constitution the right for medical marijuana for broader use and of conditions, at least theoretically, because we've seen here in Florida how constitutional amendments don't necessarily go into effect as soon as they should. And if that does pass and if legislators actually act on it, it would help end the foot-dragging in authorizing growers for which the State Department of Health was roundly criticized, and it would also remove the artificial barriers separating consumers and the product they seek.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to another call here. We've got Jason calling from Orlando. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Good. Just wanted to address a few things, just a few comments, and one specifically to the previous caller who was referencing the need for FDA approval.
Right.
Well, I think we all pretty much know that the FDA has gone out of their way to not fund any kind of research at all in the past. So they kind of made a proactive stance on not wanting to create the kind of data that we do need. And FDA approval is kind of down the line, but of course it's a Schedule I issue as well. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, my broader point is the fact that this has already been used as a medicine for a long time, for centuries. Our major pharmaceutical companies that are still in the business now use them as well. The data is there to find out. But as far as Charlotte's Web, I just want to say that I feel like Rick Scott did that in a very disingenuous way, because, you know, look what it's been wrangled up in. There's no Charlotte's Web. There have been nothing but problems as far as trying to get the licensing. And I feel like he threw that out there as kind of a bait for the public electorate to say, oh, okay, yeah, well, now there's medical marijuana, when in all actuality, they really had no intention of ever supporting any kind of medical marijuana in the state of Florida. And my last point would be is that we are the only state in the country that makes it so that we have to have 60% majority.
Mm-hmm.
How is that democratic?
And you're talking about the legislative amendments there. The ballot amendments.
Right. That which in and of itself did not receive 60% approval. I just think that there's a lot of misnomers out there. I think John Morgan's approach is the correct one. Seniors are the ones we do need to further educate. And furthermore, they are some of the people that would benefit most, in many cases, by maybe not having to take as many medications or the inability to pay for them currently. So, you know, I think Florida just needs to move into the future. I think the 58% and change in a midterm was pretty telling. I do think it will pass, but there can't be malaise on the part of the voter where they actually have to go. And yes, it's a presidential cycle, but that's possible, but can be taken for granted as well. So people actually have to get off their butts. They have to go and not just sit around and talk about it. But again, my point is mostly on Rick Scott. I really feel, and I think many other people out there feel, that this was very, very, very disingenuous. Where is the Charlotte's Web?
Right. As you say, there's a lot of red tape around that. Jason, I think you made your point. Thank you so much for calling in. I do appreciate it. Frank, I just want to throw that question to you. The caller there talking about, you know, maybe this was sort of passed, but in a way that was, you know, not as easily implemented as it could be. I guess my question would be, though, shouldn't a state like Florida, you know, be cautious and move warily when it's considering something like, you know, regulating or legalizing medical marijuana? It is kind of a big step for a state.
It is kind of a big step for a state. And Daryl mentioned it earlier, just because an amendment passes doesn't mean that it's going to go into effect right away. And you know, this just isn't a very high priority for a legislature, which the majority opposed the measure to begin with. So, you're going to see some passage. This measure will likely pass, and there could be some wrangling over its implementation to ensure how it's carried out. And it's also going to come back to municipalities. You mentioned earlier that there'll be ordinances involved and how the drugs are distributed and how it affects lives right here on the street where the rubber meets the road. So there's still a lot of question marks even after its potential passage this year.
Mm-hmm. I want to get one more call in on medical marijuana. Susan is calling from Orlando. Susan, what's on your mind on this issue?
Hey, thank you. Mm-hmm. I actually am a pharmacist at the local hospital, and I went to the University of Florida, and I had a neurology professor in pharmacy school who was all for decriminalizing the majority of illegal drugs, including marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. Mm-hmm. And she had a great argument for decriminalizing these medications, which, by the way, there is a marijuana-based medication out there called Marinol, and it's used
right.
for cancer patients.
Mm-hmm. And that, so has the compound, which is it's the non-THC compound, right? The not the compound which doesn't get you high. I think CBD, is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm. So I think that we just, as a nation, need to decriminalize marijuana use. And because it puts such a heavy burden on the criminal justice system, there are a lot of people in prison right now for marijuana possession, and it's unnecessary. And I think that if we offer this to people in general as even a recreational use, because people are going to use it recreationally, even if they say they're using it medically.
Mm-hmm.
And we just decriminalize it, legalize it across the nation. It would make the criminal justice system, number one, so much easier to maneuver if you take all of the marijuana-related crimes out of it and offer it to the people who are requesting to use it for medicinal purposes. I mean, there are many, many medications that we use in neurology specifically, that are not labeled, used for mm-hmm. neurology patients. Psychiatry patients use multiple medications that aren't labeled for psychiatry. And I think it's important to offer this as an alternative to patients who would like to try it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Susan, pharmacist perspective there from Orlando. Red, I just want to come back to you. The argument they've made about the criminal justice system, I know there are sort of steps being taken in some jurisdictions to, you know, for small amounts of possession, take that off the kind of criminal level and make it just a fine. So there are steps being taken in that regard. What are your thoughts on that idea?
Yes, there are some steps being taken on that right now to decriminalize a lot of that. So if it's small amounts of pot that people are caught with, they're definitely not, you know, arresting people for that now.
Mm-hmm.
However, the people that are in jail that are arrested on marijuana charges will likely stay there. You know, if their term is still, you know, to be in jail, they'll stay there. They won't mm-hmm. get out just because this passes. However, I think that that's a good point that people are bringing up along with the passage of this amendment,
mm-hmm.
That if they're, you know, caught with it, then they don't have to worry about being put in jail as they've been in the past.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, what's going on with regards to how lawmakers up in Tallahassee are approaching this issue?
You know, it was funny. Susan brings up a small point. A lot of people feel that way, and there's a growing sentiment among lawmakers that small amounts of marijuana, very small amounts, should be decriminalized and punishable by a fine instead of a full charge into the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's picking up steam. It might not pass this year. Because of the busy agenda they've got up there. But I think you're going to continue to see legislation like this continue to gain ground, moving towards that direction. And if one thing this medical marijuana amendment will do is it will certainly sort of free up a tolerance for legislation like that. And we'll have to see where it goes. And keep in mind, there's also a growing movement to make it recreational.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to be an issue that not only will be decided in 2016, but will continue to be an issue in years to come as well.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. When we come back from a break, we're going to go from medical marijuana to talk about police transparency. And we talked about this on the show last year. We're going to talk about what the Orlando Police Department is doing. We're also going to talk about trash in Orange County. Some residents aren't too happy with new bins and new automated pickup system. Are you one of those residents? Give us a call. And we'll circle back to an issue we covered last week, homelessness in Volusia County. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Stetson University School of Business Administration, offering the Master of Accountancy, online and in person, MBA, Professional MBA, and Executive MBA programs. Full-time MBA course can be completed in as little as 12 months. More information at stetson.edu/gograd. Stetson University, dare to be significant.
Hi, I'm LaFontaine Oliver, president and general manager of your public radio station, WMFE. The WMFE app is a powerful way to listen to WMFE live or on demand anytime you like. Visit the Apple and Android store to download it today.
Sponsored by the Rollins Crummer Graduate School of Business and ViewPost.
Support for 90.7 News comes from the Gladdening Light Symposium, January 29th to the 31st at All Saints Episcopal Church and Rollins College in Winter Park, featuring the acclaimed English poet David White and vocals by the Irish duo Owen and Molly. Details and registration at gladdeninglight.org. Gladdening Light, where art and spirit meet.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Frank Torres with the Orlando Political Observer and Retta Peoples with Florida Sun. And joining us by phone, Daryl Owens with Beacon College. And you can join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about police transparency. The Orlando Police Department says it's launching an open data portal in March. On Wednesday, they previewed some of the data that's going to be on the site pertaining to sexual assaults in Orlando. The website will feature graphs, maps, and spreadsheets with details like age and race of the offenders and where the offences took place. OPD is the only agency in Florida planning to release such data, and it's one of 30 agencies across the country as part of a White House program called the Police Data Initiative. Let's hear from Orlando Police Chief John Mina.
People could see how many arrests we make and how many times we use force. We want people to have that data for themselves so they could be more informed on what's going on and rather than just getting their information from the media.
It's Orlando Police Chief John Mina there. So how much of a difference will it make to the way the police department conducts its business and how it relates to the community it polices? Is this the right way to build trust? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Daryl Owens, is this a step in the right direction from the Orlando Police Department?
Well, yes, given the department's checkered history with excessive force, as revealed in a recent Orlando Sentinel expose, any attempt to pull back the cloak of secrecy has to be considered a positive step forward.
Mm-hmm. What are the pitfalls, though? Or are there some pitfalls of, you know, putting all that information online?
Yeah, I think the most obvious one concerns sexual offenders, not with the victims, since OPD is not publishing victims' names or addresses, but rather with the perpetrators. Now, I want to make sure you guys don't get this twisted. I'm certainly not an apologist for sexual offenders, but the fact is, although the occurrence is rare, and it's believed to be about 8 to 10%, there are false rape claims that happen, and though a falsely accused citizen may be able to survive the claim that's published in a newspaper or broadcast on the nightly news, once his or her name is put there on the web, some remnant of that report that fingers him or her as a sexual offender remains indefinitely.
And as you say, if it's on the nightly news, it's going to be online too, right? I mean, all stories that you see on the nightly news, there's going to be a digital trace of that story somewhere.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you expect other police departments in Florida to follow suit and pick up on what the Orlando Police Department's doing?
I think police departments will likely play weather-vaned to see where the wind blows. If there are good reports from this experiment, police, given the climate we're living in, where law enforcement is often seen as the dark side, for you Star Wars fans out there, police departments will be inclined, I think, to adopt a practice that shines a revealing light of transparency on their work craft.
Mm-hmm. Retta Peoples, let me come to you now. The Orlando Sentinel reporting last year had this to say about use of force in minorities. I'm quoting from their article, OPD officers use force more frequently on black suspects, 55% in a city where 28% of the population is black, end quote. But the police have also taken steps to engage with the community. They've run forums, they've taken outreach steps. Is this the right way to build trust now with putting some of this data online?
I think that that helped. You know, it's interesting that Chief Mina said that, you know, he didn't want people to just get their information from the media. However, he delivered that statement through the media. So he's using it as well. But I think putting that information online is good. But how reliable is that information coming from OPD? I know a lot of people in the black community don't believe that what OPD puts out there online is going to be true. And then also, I think as far as them, you know, getting town hall forums and putting those together, is a great start, but it's only a start. So I hope that they don't believe that that's going to be the start and end of it, because excessive force in the community, you know, the data shows that excessive force is definitely happening in the community. I believe that it's coming from fear. You know, if there's cops that are in the community that don't look like the people that they serve, that don't, you know, relate to the people that they serve, that there may be some fear there, and they may act excessively when there's an issue.
Now, what are you hearing, Rheta Peoples, from the black community in Orlando about how to build trust with the police? I mean, what's the way forward?
I think the way forward is to not stop at the town hall forums that they're having, to have more of those, to have more interaction with the people they serve. And then also to not just let this be the start and end of it, you know, to dig deeper and find out if there is fear from some of the officers that are out there serving, and, you know, try to put those things at rest.
Frank Torres, you've covered this issue of police use of force and the community reaction to it. Do you see this latest effort by the police aimed at more transparency, you know, going some way to mollify protesters?
You know, I still think, like Rheta said, that community relationship building is the main key, and being out there in the neighborhoods, not just when something wrong happens, but out there getting to know your residents and building relationships in that regards. As far as this transparency, this is a pretty neat tool. It's not just law enforcement data, but it's also municipal data, building permits, maintenance, things along those lines. I was thinking it's a terrific reporter tool. But we'll see how the rollout goes. It's due to come out in March, and I think it's a step. One translation, or one problem with translation, was the press conference had a domestic violence prevention field to it.
Right.
There were some concerns over what kind of data would be released regarding domestic violence. They did reassure us that no addresses or names of the victims would be labeled. But there was sort of problems with translation over how that data availability would help crack down domestic violence.
Well, I want to move on now and talk about a story in Orange County and what's going on with the garbage pickup there. 64,000 phone calls, 3,600 emails, and 433 actions on social media. That's just how much buzz Orange County's new bins, rolled out to great fanfare last year, have generated. But it's not all positive. Here are some recent headlines about the new once-a-week pickup and the automated collection. Orange County residents frustrated with missed garbage pickup. That's from Click Orlando. Then a website called Waste Dive described the rollout as causing, quote, chaos. WFTV also had this headline: rule breakers make for problems with Orange County's new trash system, citing residents putting their bins out facing the wrong way, stacking garbage next to the bins. Well, what's your experience been? Is this just a teething issue? 1-866-338-5252. Frank, you were at that Orange County Commission meeting this week. What's going on? Just how big a deal is this trash frustration?
You know, apparently it's a bigger deal than a lot of us think. 64,000 phone calls, 12,000 phone calls within a 24-hour period, just days after the new program launched. And it rolls out like a comedy. People don't know how to put out these new 95-gallon carts, which are very heavy for some people.
Right. If you've got it loaded up, it's a struggle.
Right. And then there are reports. One commissioner said that the contractors hired by the county are cutting corners and throwing recyclables in with the regular trash and, you know, disregarding bulk collection of the bulk items. We got black bears in Apopka that are being drawn to neighborhoods by the leftover trash by these contractors, and it really has gotten off to a terrible start. Everybody's committed to trying to make it better, but you just have no idea how little things like trash pickup can throw off a community the way it has this week.
Darrell Owens, let me throw this to you. Seminole County is rolling out new rules for trash next month, and just a week or two, in fact. Those rules designed to curb potentially deadly bear versus human interactions, Frank just mentioned, you know, the bears being attracted to the trash being left out at the wrong times, for example. So given this furor over new trash rules in Orange County, should Seminole County be starting to worry about how its new ordinance will shake out?
Well, we all know that unanimity is a political unicorn, so no matter what you do, for whatever reason, there's going to be some nattering naysayers out there. But that said, so far, none of the Seminole cities at Ground Zero have rejected the rules, although there have been some residents in Seminole County's Woodland subdivision who have sought an exclusion to the new ordinance requiring bear-proof trash cans because they say that Yogi and Boo Boo aren't prowling the community for picnic baskets there.
Darrell, I was fossicking through some Sentinel articles and found a piece you wrote back in the 90s about the town of Oakland adopting new recycling rules and the slow start to that program. You know, why is garbage and recycling, why is it such a contentious issue?
Well, how we manage our trash is a significant issue. It all gets down to the cost for doing so, convenience for the residents, and just, I guess, plain old patterns of how we do things. So any proposal that upsets the apple cart is bound to get pushback from critics who want to toss it out into the round file.
Mm-hmm. Rita, coming back to the Orange County garbage bin issue and how it relates to Seminole County's issue with bears and trash, you know, once a fortnightly pickup could lead to some trash being left by the curb for once a week pickup, rather, could leave some trash being left out for longer than it should be. Do you see a bear problem developing in Orange County, too?
Oh, dear God, I hope not. You know, I hope we don't have to deal with a bear problem in Orange County. But you know what? If we're leaving trash out that way, we just might.
Mm-hmm. The Orlando Sentinel quotes a Lake County spokesperson in an article they wrote about this issue. And that spokesperson said it took 6 months for Lake County to work out the kinks in their program when they switched to automated trash pickup. Orange County residents going to be that patient?
I don't think so. You know, like Frank said, with 12,000 calls within 24 hours, I don't think they're going to have that type of patience. And also one issue is that the trucks are smaller than they were before, so they're not able to hold as much trash this time around as prior to before. So they've got some kinks to work out there, but we're hoping that they can do that within 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, what are you hearing from the county? You know, they had that PR campaign to alert people that these new bins were happening, a new trash pickup. Are they having to kind of rethink the way that PR campaign worked?
You know, Mayor Jacobs, while addressing the issue, called on the media to help out the county to get the word out about this new garbage pickup system. And the county was a little bit reluctant to do this during the voting process late last year, and there is a fail-safe that they voted on and enacted that will allow them to revisit the terms with the contractors and regarding everything else should this thing go completely downhill. But, you know, as far as the immediate future goes, they're going to stick with education and trying to get people aware, and they're just going to try to weather the storm regardless of the phone calls and emails and other miscellaneous problems that could pop up in the meanwhile.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, I want to come back to a story we covered last Friday, homelessness in Volusia County and how the problem is to the fore in Daytona Beach, where dozens of homeless people are camping out in front of a county building. There's also a bit of tension between city and county officials. It's not just in Daytona Beach either. There are signs of progress, too, with cities teaming up to pay for a future resource center for the homeless. In fact, 9 cities have agreed to help pay for that 24-hour shelter. Here's Daytona Commissioner Pam Woods talking to WMFE.
Every one of them wants to do something to help the homeless. That's not the issue. The issue is, how do you fund it? And how do you make it fair and equitable? And then how do you sustain that funding? That's always been the dilemma for us.
So a few things to work out there. Meanwhile, Volusia County has pledged $4 million towards the project. And in the immediate term, an emergency shelter has opened, but not all of the beds are full. So is enough being done, and has it been done fast enough to solve that problem? And what does it say about deeper issues with poverty in the county and maybe across central Florida? Daryl, what's your take on this, having seen now that Orange County and Orlando officials are sort of mobilizing to tackle homelessness? Is this Volusia County's moment to sort of seize this issue and do something about it?
Perhaps. On one hand, I guess it's a positive that a spotlight has been thrown on this issue, but on the other hand, I'm not quite sure that an emergency shelter is the panacea.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've written about this issue for years with the Sentinel. What approaches have you seen that seem to have worked?
Well, let me first tell you what doesn't work. Past ideas in Volusia to give the homeless a bus ticket out of town, that doesn't work. But there are myriad approaches that have, to some degree, proven efficacious. Last night, I attended the Orlando Sentinel's Central Floridian of the Year Awards, where Andre Bailey, who runs the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness, was honored for his work in championing and piloting the Housing First strategy that has significantly reduced intractable homelessness among veterans here in greater Orlando. So Housing First, which puts the homeless in homes with supportive services attached, appears to pay dividends.
Mm-hmm.
But in short, what all those strategies that have proven successful over time have in common is one thing, and that's compassion. And it doesn't work unless that compassion goes viral in the community that is dealing with the homelessness problem.
Mm-hmm. Rita Peoples, you know, how does homelessness fit into this broader narrative of poverty? And I'm kind of wondering if you'd see it keeping the attention of officials if there weren't that encampment out there in front of that building to show.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, we can find the money to fund this this problem. However, we've got to get to the root of the problem. Why are the families homeless? You know, why are individuals homeless? You know, there may be some issues that are going on with the family. Maybe sickness, you know, hits the family. And then, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck. And before you know it, they've lost their home. Mm-hmm. If we can, you know, get those families back into homes and then also find out what the root of the problem is, have a social worker to work with them on those issues. And I think that we won't have the repetitiveness of the repetition of people being homeless over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Frank, in the last 15 seconds or so, we did hear from a Daytona City Commissioner that cities and other partners are working together on this. Is this kind of the uniting force? Is homelessness what's, you know, bringing all these elected officials together?
That's the only way to solve it. I mean, Orlando struggled with this for years until they finally started making ground this year with the commission, which brought all three counties together, public and private sectors, to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres is the editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thank you so much for joining us, Frank.
Thanks so much for having me.
Retta Peoples is columnist with the Florida Sun. Thanks for coming in, Retta.
Thank you.
And Daryl Owens joined us by phone. He's a former editorial writer and columnist with the Sentinel, now communications director with Beacon College. Thank you so much, Daryl.
Anytime, Matthew.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance today from Alex Gasparini. And the executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.